Let's go, girls.
Welcome to the AmeriChicks with Kim Monson and Molly Vogt. Molly is a former mutual fund consultant and retirement plan specialist who is currently the director and founder of My Purse Politics. Kim served as a city councilwoman, is a former investment broker, and now a successful entrepreneur. Now, let's hear what's hatching in local and national politics with the AmeriChicks. Molly and Kim.
Hey, welcome to the AmeriChicks. Molly Vogt and Kim Monson. I'm Kim Monson.
I'm Molly Vogt.
We hope you are having a fabulous Friday, and we love Fridays because it is our World War II project day with the AmeriChicks.
It sure is. You know, it's a really nice way to end the week with something just positive. Learn something, education. Learn about the greatest generation. Why wouldn't we want to learn about the great history of America's sacrifice and our great leaders?
Yeah. Well, be sure and check out our website. It's AmeriChicks.com, and that's where we are on Facebook and Twitter as well. And very excited today to have Professor Victor Davis Hanson with us. He has a brand new book out. It's called The Second World Wars. And Professor Victor Davis Hanson is one of the great thinkers of our day, Molly. He's a nationally respected speaker, author, and he's teaches the classics in military history at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University in California.
Right. Yes, he's awesome. And we've talked to him about many, many different things. And I know, you know, people out there, you have probably seen, this is only one of many books. I think Victor Davis Hanson's written or edited up to 24 books total, hundreds of articles, editorials, scholarly papers. You see him all over all the news stations as well on many different topics. But the very interesting thing is the fact that we're going to be talking about World War II today with Victor Davis Hanson. And Professor Hanson has family members who served in World War II. And he talks about that in the book, and we'll talk about that today. But so he really does bring together not only his own historian eye view of what happened, but he's going to have some family history to share as well.
Yeah, very excited about it. So Professor Victor Davis Hanson, welcome to the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a great honor to get to talk with you. This is quite a book. I just started it, so I'm very excited to read it. But I would like to just mention the first few paragraphs in the preface. As I started to read those, it took my breath away regarding your relatives and their service in the war.
Yeah, we were from a kind of old farming family. And when the war hit, my father and his first cousin, who was sort of his adopted brother, joined the Marine Corps. And then one went into B-29s and the other was in the Marine Corps, and he was killed on Okinawa, and I was named after him, Victor Hanson. Last day of the fighting on Sugarloaf Hill. And my dad actually survived 40 missions over Tokyo. And then uncles, first cousins, I had two first cousins that were, my mother's two first cousins were killed, one in Normandy right after the landing and another in the Philippines. And I think almost everybody I grew up with, as I remember, was in the war, and it was true of my grandfather, who was gassed in the Argonne in World War I and was sort of disabled most of his life. But so I was always interested in World War II. They all talked about it. One of the themes of the book is that it never seemed to me like it could be the same war, because I had one uncle was in Alaska fighting the Japanese, of all things, and then I had another father 30,000 feet up in the air in a B-29. I heard about jungle fighting and dense brush in Okinawa about my namesake. And then I had a first cousin who was fighting with Patton in a tank. And then my other uncle was a supply officer in Iran trying to shuttle trucks to the Russians. And I could go on, but you get the impression that when the war after 1941 reached from the Arctic Circle in Norway all the way to the Sahara and from the Volga River in eastern Russia, or central Russia, all the way to the English Channel, and then in the Pacific from Alaska to the Indian Ocean, from China to Wake Island, it was most of the globe. And with 2 billion people alive at that time, over a billion and a half were some way involved in it. 27,000 people were killed every day of the 6 years.
It's astonishing. One of the reasons, Professor Hanson, that Molly and I started our World War II project, and basically, we have a World War II vet on with us every Friday afternoon. We accompanied a team that took four D-Day vets to Normandy in 2016. And I always knew that that was important. I've always been interested in the war. But as we've gone through all of these different interviews, what you've just described was something that I had not understood, that this was so far reaching throughout the globe. And here, and like you mentioned, I'm from a farming community in Western Kansas. Three of my uncles served in World War II. And I'm just thinking about, you know, these kids that grew up on a farm, and then the next thing you know, they're someplace on the globe fighting. I just have come to think that that is so powerful.
Yeah, I tried to convey that in the title, that we think of it as just a simple world war, but in fact, it was fought so many places under so many different circumstances. And the alliances were so strange that nobody really knew what was going on. Somebody in Bulgaria fighting with the Germans in Russia had no allegiance to somebody on the same so-called team alliance in Japan fighting in Manchuria. And by the same token, a Polish resistance fighter fighting the Germans in what was East Prussia really didn't have a lot of common with a British guy fighting the Japanese in Burma. And that was one of the things I wanted to convey. The other was that there was two cycles of the war. From 1939, September 1st, when Hitler invaded Poland, he had nine wars that went on, and he was successful in all but one. And he didn't lose the one against Britain. It was just a draw. So he invaded Poland. He invaded Denmark, Norway, Luxembourg, Belgium, Holland, France, Yugoslavia, Greece, and then suddenly, you know, the blitz against, during this time, the blitz against Britain, and he won all of those, so the entire EU was under his control. And when Japan attacked us, they had most of all of Manchuria and about a half of China. And then quickly, all the Pacific fell. But then they did something very stupid in their arrogance. They declared war on two countries who, together with Britain, had almost 2.5 times their population. The Soviet Union, United States, and Britain had about 420 million. Japan, Italy, and Germany only had about 160, 70 million. And we had had a pre-war GDP about 7 times what the Axis did. And most importantly, in their arrogance, when they started that existential war, they didn't really understand why they had been successful in these border wars. And it was largely because they surprise attacked everybody. Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor. They attacked the British at Singapore. They attacked Hong Kong. They had attacked the Philippines. They went into China by surprise. Britain, Germany surprised France and Poland, and et cetera. But they'd never really fought very far from their home bases. And that, by that, I mean they didn't have the ability logistically or in terms of transportation to supply long convoys of armies or to drop parachuters or to have amphibious landings far from home, and when they didn't have the element of surprise. And most importantly, they had no ability to reach Detroit, where we were making a B-24 an hour within 2 years, or the Kaiser shipyards in Oakland, or they couldn't even bomb Manchester or Liverpool with much efficacy. And they couldn't get to the Soviet Union beyond the Ural Mountains, where all their factories had been relocated. So I guess what I'm saying is, why would you start a global war when you had no ability to destroy the manpower and industrial sources of your enemy, but you picked a fight with people who had four-engine bombers, aircraft carriers, and the two largest navies in the world? And so from the very beginning of 1942, when this global second phase started, we were able to very quickly get to Berlin and get to Tokyo and get to Rome, we being the allies, and that wasn't true of what they were able to do. So it was basically bullies that had killed civilians. And remember, 80% of the people, the 65 million who died, were civilians, and 80% of the 80%, 60% of that 65 million were Chinese, Russian, and Eastern Europeans that were killed by Germans and Japanese. So basically the war, in some sense, was Japanese soldiers and German soldiers butchering men, women, and children in Eastern Europe, Russia, and China. And that is what they had been very good at. But what they were not good at was fighting an existential global war against powers like the Soviet Union, United States, or the British Empire. And they got themselves in a jam by the end of 1941.
Well, Professor Hansen, what you mentioned about the civilian losses in this particular war, do you think that's unique to the Second World Wars?
Yes, it was. There's no doubt about it. In World War One, the majority of fatalities, as true of the Civil War, as true of most of European wars, had been, and true of the Napoleonic Wars, had been soldiers. What was new about World War II was it was basically a war against people who were unarmed. We in the West keep talking about Hamburg and Dresden and Tokyo as if, you know, we bombed civilians, and we did. But that aggregate of civilians who were bombed by American and British bombers was about 1.3 million. But we have to put things in perspective in two senses. One, they killed about 55 million, 50 to 55 million civilians, they being Germany and Japan. And two, when we started this war, we were very unprepared and we were gearing up and we had no way to stop that killing. So in some sense, we found out very quickly that the way to stop the Japanese killing people in China or butchering people in Burma or killing people in Indonesia or the Germans running the Holocaust at 10,000 a day in Auschwitz by 43 was to bomb their cities, their infrastructure. And it may have been messy, it may have been inaccurate, there may have been a lot of collateral damage, but when you go back to that time and space, it's hard to know how you can stop those juggernauts.
Well, Professor Hansen, let's go to break. When we come back, let's talk about some of the factors leading up to World War II, and let's see if there's any commonality with some of the things that's going on today. So this is the Americhex, Molly and Kim with Professor Victor Davis Hansen. We'll be right back.
If you're a veteran looking to purchase a home, choose the local experts, Kim Sturtz and Mark Cook at Home Mortgage Alliance. VA loans offer qualifying veterans the option to buy without a down payment. And since these loans are government insured, limited closing fees. Active duty military, reserves, National Guard, retired military, and surviving spouses may qualify. Give Kim Sturtz or Mark Cook at Home Mortgage Alliance a call today at 303-888-2732. Or check them out on the Americhex referral list at Americhex.com. Home Mortgage Alliance LLC is an approved FHA lender and sponsored agent of VA loans. NMLS number 1137507.
When buying or selling your home, you need a top-notch negotiator with experience. Award-winning RE/MAX Alliance Realtor Karen Levine has helped individuals navigate the ups and downs of the Denver real estate market for over 25 years. Karen Levine is honest, trustworthy, and has your best interests in mind. Let Karen help you find the right home for your lifestyle. Call Karen at 303-877-7516 for a no-cost consultation. That's 303-877-7516 or visit her online at Karen-Levine.com and tell her the Americhex sent you. Bookkeeping, accounting, and taxes. Oh my! No need to worry about your company or personal finances with the proven professionals at Predovich & Company. Predovich & Company are certified public accountants who offer exceptional services to individuals, businesses, and nonprofits. Serving the South Metro area, the team at Predovich & Company strives to take a proactive approach in understanding your tax, accounting, and bookkeeping needs and situation. Give Predovich & Company a call at 303-791-3000 or check out their website at dpredovich.com and be sure to tell them the Americhex sent you.
It's time. October is here, and the scary features are hitting the screen. Please join the historic 88 Drive-In Theater and be sure to bring someone to hold on to for their upcoming triple features. Admission at 88 Drive-In Theater is only $8 per person, and children under 12 are free. Your admission includes all features. Stay for one or all three. New fall box office hours are 6 p.m. Friday and Saturday and 6:30 p.m. Monday through Thursday. To stay up to date on movie showings and times, go to 88drivein.net and like the 88 Drive-In on Facebook. And be sure to tell them the Americhex sent you.
Hey, welcome back to the Americhex World War II Project Show. Molly Vogt and Kim Munson on KDMT. Every Friday is our favorite day because we get to talk about this history and the greatest generation. But real quick, you just heard the commercial for the historic 88 Drive-In Movie Theater. It is Halloween time, and wanted to let you know they've got you covered as far as the Halloween movies. So get out there this weekend. You've got Flatliners at 7 p.m., Happy Death Day at 8:50 p.m., and It at 10:25 p.m. Doesn't sound like your favorites, Kimmy, but maybe you go get your scare on.
Yeah, I'll just have the funnel cake with all the different toppings. How's that?
Yes, well, they've got five different options. Fluffernuddle is the newest, and it's marshmallow cream and peanut butter.
Yum.
So that sounds good. So check out the historic 88drivein.com right here in Colorado. So let's get back to the show. So on World War II Day, Friday is such a big deal for Kimmy and I because we had the opportunity to go to Normandy D-Day 2016 with four World War II vets, and just to hear their stories and see their eyes and really just see how the French people reacted to them being there. They were so thankful for the sacrifice that our men and women made for them during the war. We said, you know what, we've got to get as much information as we can about this war, record the stories of our veterans, and share it with people for future. So today we've got a special guest. He didn't serve in World War II, but many of his family members did, and you know him. He's very, very popular. Professor Victor Davis Hanson. He is probably one of the U.S.'s preeminent military historians. He's been a commentator on modern and ancient warfare on multiple news outlets, written and edited 24 books. His most recent one right now is The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. And this just came out October 17th. And already on Amazon, it says it's a number one bestseller. So
people like his books.
People like it. It's a good thing. So thank you, Professor Hanson, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We sure appreciate it. So obviously, you know, you talked a little bit about in the first segment about the reason that you're so into this. You had so many family members that actually did serve during the Second World War, but you say wars because it's on so many different fronts. And before we went to break, we were starting to talk about, you know, what were some of the factors that led to the outbreak of the Second World War? And if you don't mind, just kind of comparing, is there anything you see today that may be similar happening now that was happening then that we might need to be aware of if we want to avoid conflict?
Yeah. When we look back at the war, we think, why in the world would Japan and Germany and Italy declare war on the alliance of the Soviets and the Americans and the British that had so many more resources, biggest and second biggest and biggest navies in the world, economies that would be 10 times larger, population 2.5 times. And the answer is that in 1939, when they started these border wars, they were convinced that even though their enemies, in this case France and Britain, in this case Germany, had more soldiers than the French and the British did. They had just as good planes. They had better tanks. But the winners had been traumatized by World War I, and the losers had been defiant and thought they wanted to try this again. So what I'm getting at is they lost a sense of deterrence, and that means that when an aggressor surveys the landscape, they make decisions. Is it in our interest to take a risk? Is there more to be gained than to be lost? In the case of Germany, he said they won't fight, or they won't fight well, or their heart is not in it. And his generals kept saying, you can't do this, mein Führer. They have too many men. They have better planes than we do. The Spitfire is as good as the ME-109. And he said, I know these people. I saw them at Munich. They will not fight. And the same was true of the Japanese. They said, the Americans will not fight us. They let London burn. They didn't even lift a finger once we hit Pearl Harbor. That was wrong. But the question we have today is, why did they think that? And the answer is deterrence is it's not just military strength, but it's the perception that you're unpredictable and you may use it. And so had we in 1939 told the Axis, especially the Germans, if the British had not appeased them in the 30s, and if the Russians had not colluded with them and joined a partnership as Stalin did with Hitler for 2 years, and had the United States not been isolationist, then we would have been able to demonstrate what would have happened had they gone into France or Poland. But Hitler was convinced we wouldn't do anything. And I guess the lesson is that we think that wars are started by accident or miscommunications. Very rarely in history they are. They're usually started by misconceptions, and mostly that a strong power is considered weak by the aggressor. And then war becomes a laboratory where you, at great tragic expense, you find out who actually was strong and who was weak. So what happened is they misjudged the United States and Britain and Soviets because all three were not able, before the war started, to demonstrate what would happen if Hitler or the Japanese were aggressive. And we took a war to find out what we knew before the war, that the Axis were weaker. Now, when you look at the world today, like North Korea, you think, wow, he's insane given our 6,600 nuclear weapons, and he's got 12. Our economy is thousands of times larger than his. His population is just a 12th of ours. What is Kim Jong-un doing? But deterrence also is predicated on the willingness and the communications to him what would happen. So what I'm afraid of is that North Korea really doesn't know how powerful the United States is and really doesn't believe after 30 years of appeasement that we're going to do anything. And that's going to make him take risks that may cause a war. And when the war comes, he will find out very quickly how weak he is. But what a tragedy that will be and how many lives will be lost that we don't need to. So it's incumbent upon this administration to let the North Koreans, let the Chinese know this is what's going to happen to you. These are our assets. We're perfectly willing to use them. And we have a lot of steps short of war that we will take, and that way we can deter him. But if we follow the pattern of the Clinton, the Bush, and the Obama administrations and try to talk with them or appease them or give them money, he's going to interpret that outreach not as magnanimity to be reciprocated, but as weakness to show contempt to. I think that's the story of World War II, and I just hope that we've learned it.
And Professor Victor Davis Hanson, thank you for comparing that with North Korea. How about Iran right now? It's a little bit of a different animal, but still we've kind of been kicking the can down the road with them as well. And with the nuclear agreement, we've given them the opportunity to build up strength against us.
Yes, I think they understand that the Obama administration's prime directive was at best not to have them get a bomb on his watch. And so they cut a deal that was very favorable to them. And I mean favorable in the widest sense of the word. There were not spot inspections. There was going to be a drop of the embargo and sanctions against them. There was nothing about their ability to make intercontinental missiles in the agreement. And there was nothing to stop their terrorist activity. They cut a swath all the way from Iran to the Mediterranean. And they knew that. And they thought Obama really wants this deal, and then once he's out, we can start back. They never thought Trump was going to be elected. They assumed that Hillary would continue that reset with them, and we'll see now. But they're much weaker than we are, and there's a lot of things that we can do sanction-wise. It's just a tragedy that we had them on the ropes, and their oil industry was outdated. It didn't have spare parts. There was an international embargo against Iran. They had a lot of debt. And then we just infused billions of dollars into their economy and without the ability to monitor them. And they interpreted that again as the United States was weak and they were desperate for an agreement. And so even though we're so much stronger, you don't want to give that impression because we've given it with Iran for 30 years since the Carter administration.
Well, Professor Hanson, I think that America was weaker. The perception was correct that America was weaker under the previous administrations. And while President Trump, when he talks tough, I mean, people kind of take notice and some people don't like it at all. But it seems like in light of what you're talking about, that is very important to send that message.
It is. I get very depressed when I hear what they say, they meaning our establishment. They said, well, Trump called him Rocket Man, and that's going to trigger a war. But if you go throughout history, there's never been a war triggered by a tough word. I mean, Ronald Reagan had a hot mic that said, we start bombing the Soviet Union in 5 minutes. It didn't start a war. What starts a war is just the opposite. It's when Dean Acheson says, South Korea is not under the American protective umbrella. It's when April Glaspy says to Saddam, we have no interest in a border war with Kuwait, you and Kuwait. It's when people in Britain say, we'll start calling the Falklands the Malvinas. Any time an aggressor detects that their target is weak or wants anything other than to resist them, they strike. And when the target seems unpredictable, a little crazy, capable of anything, they don't strike. And so with Trump, what bothers us may not be necessarily all that bad, especially when he's got a good national security team. Kim Jong-un may conclude this guy's a little different than the predictable American president of the last 8 years. We don't know what he's going to do, but we do know he has a huge arsenal, so we better be careful.
Huge.
And that seems counterintuitive, but we can do a lot of things to pressure North Korea. We can tell the Chinese, you know, not only are we going to clamp down on trade, but why do Chinese members of the Communist Party have visas to come to the United States? Why are their children in American universities? Why are they buying property? There's a whole steps that we can escalate short of war that would get China's attention, that they created North Korean problem and they can solve it. But they're not going to do that unless they feel that the price is too great to keep supporting North Korea. Everybody makes a cost-benefit analysis, and mm-hmm. you have to convince the Chinese that North Korea is a bad deal. And we can, without going to war, if we have the resolution to do so.
Well, that's fascinating regarding North Korea and Iran. Let's move back to your book and the Second World Wars. And one of the things that you mentioned is that there were some classical precedents that were forgotten during the Second World Wars. And how did that impact the outcomes?
Well, when people looked at history, let's just look at the Mediterranean. If you want to control the Mediterranean, whether you're in the Punic Wars with Rome against Carthage, or whether you're in the Napoleonic Wars, or whether you're in the rise of the British Empire or the Ottoman Wars, there were always four or five hinges: Gibraltar, Malta, Sicily, Crete, and Cyprus. And if you could control those islands and the entrance, you could win the Mediterranean. But for some reason, the Axis took Crete, and they had Sicily, but they never seriously tried to take Gibraltar, and they never could take Malta. And so basically, history would have reminded them, you're not going to win. History would also say, you can't really invade the Soviet Union from the West, because by the time you invade, it's usually May or June because of the rains and the mud. And then you only have 3 months to go about 1,500 miles, and the Russians may fight very poorly, as they did in World War II in Finland and in Poland, but they fight very well on their home soil. So whether you're Charles XI of Sweden or whether you're Napoleon, it's always a bad idea to invade Russia from the West, and yet Hitler did it. And so there were lessons across time and space. If you're going to invade Italy, you should never do it from Sicily, because you have to go up 600 miles in a long spine of mountainous terrain. And you can be cut off. It's always better to go from Switzerland down, as Napoleon and Hannibal knew.
Okay.
But these lessons weren't really clear to a lot of people in World War II because of technology. They thought that they were so advanced that technology had changed the equation.
Okay, Professor Hansen, that is absolutely fascinating. We are talking with Professor Victor Davis Hansen regarding his new book, The Second World Wars.
Dude, I need help. How can I perfect my golf swing and keep my promise to put in a whole new kitchen by next month?
No worries. Call Rafe and Colin at Harmony Ridge Construction. They've been doing this for 40 years all over the globe. Trust me, they'll make you look like a genius, and you'll have more time to perfect that golf swing. You really need to work on that.
Great. I'll give Harmony Ridge Construction a call today. What's their number?
720-660-0265. Or visit them online at harmonyridgeconstruction.com. They're best for any small fix or large remodel. They'll help you out.
Guy Whiddon, 101st Airborne, landed Normandy in the dark on D-Day 1944, was knocked out on the jump, woke up, a gun to his head. What happened next? If you love the AmeriChicks World War II project on Fridays and know a World War II vet, we'd love to share their story. We're in a race against time to gather as many stories as possible and as quickly as possible to preserve them for all future generations. So if you know a World War II vet or have that great World War II story to share, email us at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. That's the AmeriChicks@gmail.com.
If you're a veteran looking to purchase a home, choose the local experts, Kim Sturtz and Mark Cook at Home Mortgage Alliance. VA loans offer qualifying veterans the option to buy without a down payment. And since these loans are government insured, limited closing fees. Active duty military, reserves, National Guard, retired military, and surviving spouses may qualify. Give Kim Sturtz or Mark Cook at Home Mortgage Alliance a call today at 303-888-2732. Or check them out on the AmeriChicks referral list at AmeriChicks.com. Home Mortgage Alliance LLC is an approved FHA lender and sponsored agent of VA loans. NMLS number 1137507.
Are you concerned, perplexed about the events happening in America today? Where can you go for answers? Check out the Centennial Institute at Colorado Christian University. The Centennial Institute sponsors research, events, and publications so that you can understand the most important issues facing our state and nation. By proclaiming truth, they foster faith, family, and freedom, teach citizenship, and renew the spirit of 1776. Check out their website at ccu.edu to read their latest publications and find a schedule of upcoming events. That's ccu.edu.
God bless America and all of those men and women who have risked all, sacrificed so much to protect us, People who have served, people who are serving, and people who will serve. Thank you, thank you, thank you from the Americhicks, Molly and Kim. Welcome back. So we are sitting here on the telephone with Professor Victor Davis Hanson, and check out VictorHanson.com and his brand new book, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. It's on Amazon right now. It just came out October 17th. It's already a number one bestseller. And of course, you know why. Victor Davis Hanson is one of the U.S. preeminent military historians in our country. And the great thing is he has done so much research, not only on the most recent warfare, but ancient warfare. So he's really putting together the entire picture for us. And Professor Hanson, you know, I like to think if you don't learn your history, you're doomed to repeat it. And I feel like we have some things that are taking place today that probably took place during World War II or leading up to World War II. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind, on our World War II show today. So, you know, right now it feels to me like we're in a culture war here in America. Kim and I have been inviting people to talk about, to engage in the battlefield of ideas. And, you know, rather than just disliking somebody because their political stance is different than you, actually finding out, you know, what is it that you stand for and why? And then finding out what other people stand for and why. And you know, Martin Luther King told us not to judge each other by the color of our skin, but the content of our character. But it seems like things are pretty hectic here. But you know what? They were that way right before and during World War II as well in Germany and other parts of the world, Professor Hanson. And I just wonder, let's talk a little bit about that. In your book, you talked about the fact that Germany reformulated some ancient ideas of racial and cultural superiority. And I think we're doing it again.
Yeah, they did. They felt that they had surrendered in World War I. In foreign soil on the offensive. True, but they were just about ready to collapse. And the Allies had never occupied Germany in 1919. And so they created this myth that, well, we didn't have as many people and we didn't have as much industry, but we still almost won World War I because we were racially superior. That was before Hitler. Hitler came along and amplified and focused that. And we fought World War II for all our imperfections, to stop tribalism. We said that there shouldn't be a word Volk, German word for racially pure German, or Raza in Spanish under Franco, or Raza in Italian, or Yamato in Japanese. So one of the things we said is that for all our imperfection, women didn't have full rights, minorities didn't have full rights, but we were better than the alternative. And the alternative was this racialist supremacy, supposedly, and of the fascist powers. And the irony is that generation, unlike our own, they didn't believe that they had to be perfect to be good. They believed they were self-critical and evolving, and they were better than the alternative. But in our society, we look at history as melodrama rather than tragedy. And so we go back and we pick winners and losers based on 2017 perceptions of whether you're liberal or illiberal on race, class, and gender, and we just forget everything else, the material conditions, the poverty, the ambiguity. And that's why history's not so fun to read or watch even on TV, because it becomes a sermon. And I think people on the left keep lecturing people. Now, they're saying, you must listen. If you go to take a history class, it can't be disinterested or inductive. It has to be, you come in at point A and you're going to leave this class at point B, that where I want you to. And I think what's happening now is that whether it's the NFL or the statue controversy, is people are just saying, let's take a breath. This country is exceptional. It's far better than the alternative. We know it's not perfect, but we're not going to any longer be lectured to, you people, because, you know, three generations, six generations, they're going to look back at us and they're going to ask ourselves, why did you allow safe spaces, which were segregated spaces on campus? Mm-hmm. Or why did you have censorship and call it trigger warnings?
Yeah.
Or why were you afraid to use certain words you had to call overseas contingency operations for terror? Or why did you leave Iraq and allow it just to become an ISIS wasteland when you'd really won the war? They're going to do the same thing that we do to other generations. And this generation has got it in their head that somehow they're perfect. And they don't understand that the human condition is flawed. And so I think a lot of the pushback in the last election was, we don't want to be lectured anymore, especially by people whose idea, they don't really live by the consequences of their own ideology. If they want open borders or they want, that's fine, but then live under the consequences. Don't put your children in private schools or live in gated communities. And the same thing on a lot of issues. A lot of the divisiveness is people want sincerity. They do not want an elite telling them all day long, hectoring how bad you are and how bad your history is. And yet they enjoy all the fruits of capitalism and they live sort of segregated elite lifestyles. And that really enrages people. That's insult to injury.
Yeah. You know, Professor Hansen, what you're describing, I've been very concerned about where education has been headed in America. And as we've moved into, and we've talked about this before, about relativism, you know, and I think that we are not giving our youth a foundation. When everything's relative, there's no foundation. And then there's no place to stand. And I really think that our young people are hungry for a foundation and also for order in their lives.
They do. They've just been given platitudes and they don't have a series of facts. So just to take World War II again, they don't know when it started or when it ended or what El Alamein was or what Guadalcanal was. And then more importantly, they're not inductive thinkers. They don't look at examples and then draw conclusions. They start with a conclusion and then they make the examples fit. I know that when I teach World War II, most of the students have heard only two or three things, and one of them is we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then if I ask this generation, well, what would you do? Would you invade Japan with 1 million people, casualties, wounded, or would you take all the bombers from World War II that were idle in the European theater, B-17s, 24s, and would you add them to the B-29s, and would you have 10,000 bombers and bomb Japan for 6 months? Because that would be 10 times the casualties of Hiroshima. And then they look bewildered, and you say, well, you know, life is not 100% good or 100% bad. It's making choices that's better than the alternative. They didn't have a lot of choices if they were going to save, as I said, 20,000 people dying a day in the Pacific theater. And these were Chinese that were being butchered by Japanese. They were being butchered in Burma. They were Allied prisoners who were being butchered in the Philippines. And how do you stop that? You either have to invade Japan or you have to burn down their industries because they won't quit, or you can drop an atomic bomb. So when you put it that way, then the students get interested and they think, well, I want to read about all of these examples. I didn't know this. I was just told in high school that the Allies just wanted to kill a bunch of people who weren't white or something. They were racist. And that's what's sad. It's a deductive lesson, and largely race, class, and gender lesson that they've received, but they don't have any of the tools to think independently because they don't read, they don't understand inductive thinking, and that's terrible. When they just know that if they're deductive and they parrot a particular line in a university or school, then things are much easier. There's just not as much hassle. People don't get angry. They fit the mold. They get through. They get their grades. They pay off their student loans. And that's sort of what George Orwell in 1984 mm-hmm. in Animal Farm were warning us against.
Yeah. And, you know, Professor Hansen, I know that also I think a lot of our kids aren't hearing the truth. They're not even being presented the truth in schools these days. You know, we're here in Colorado, and we've heard that from several parents with schools in junior high and high school that they're giving totally different reasons of even why Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. They say it was because Americans were killing their whaling industry. I joke you not. But, you know, when we have our World War II veterans on the air with us, we ask them, especially the ones that served in the Pacific Theater, what did they think about us dropping the atomic bombs? And they all have said, you know, we had to do it. If we had not done it, there would have been hundreds of thousands of more lives killed because they were dealing with the kamikaze pilots at the end of the war that they didn't care. It was like ISIS suicide bombers now. They didn't care about their lives. And there's no way that you're going to negotiate with somebody that doesn't care about dying. And they're sending, you know, planes in to your boats and to all of your men to take them out. So I think it's good to hear from them.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I mean, one of the most deadly weapons we have in our arsenal is a cruise missile, but a Japanese Zero with a 1,000-pound bomb on a one-way mission was a cruise missile, and the human brain was just as sophisticated a navigational instrument as a computer. So when you put a Japanese pilot in a Zero, and he was flying 3 feet above the ocean headed toward a carrier at night, there was no way to stop it. and he doubled his range because he never had to get back. Mm-hmm. So he could, instead of going 800 miles, he could go 1,600 miles. There were 7,000 kamikaze planes and pilots ready to attack. It was like 7,000 cruise missiles pointed at the American fleet had we invaded. So we didn't have a lot of good choices unless we wanted to lose a million casualties or burn down Japan with conventional napalm. Mm-hmm. We could have done either one, but it would have been a lot more costly than the atomic attack.
Yes, Professor Hansen, I think definitely from what we've heard with our World War II vets, it saved a lot of lives.
When buying or selling your home, you need a top-notch negotiator with experience. Award-winning RE/MAX Alliance Realtor Karen Levine has helped individuals navigate the ups and downs of the Denver real estate market for over 25 years. Karen Levine is honest, trustworthy, and has your best interests in mind. Let Karen help you find the right home for your lifestyle. Call Karen at 303-877-7516 for a no-cost consultation. That's 303-877-7516. Or visit her online at karen-levine.com and tell her the AmeriChicks sent you.
Hey, if you like what you're hearing from the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, chances are your future clients do too. Let us help you promote your business and fatten up your wallet. To feature your business on the AmeriChicks program, email us at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. We feature the most topical news and intriguing guests every weekday during afternoon drive time, 5 to 6 p.m., while you and your clients are enjoying the program on your way home from work. So become a sponsor today by emailing the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. That's the AmeriChicks@gmail.com. Or visit us online at AmeriChicks.com.
Today you need to have a great online and social media presence, and the best in the biz is Desi On Demand. The AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, personally work with Brandon, the founder of Desi On Demand. Desi On Demand is instrumental with our video projects, Chick Chat, Exceptional Endeavors, and our World War II project. We most heartily endorse his creativity, innovation, dedication, and integrity. Brandon and his team bring all that to the table. Check out Desi On Demand's website at mydesi.com or call 303-359-1522 for more info, and be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you.
In a world of uncertainty, anything can happen. It pays to protect yourself, your family, your business, your home, and your car. And it pays to work with the proven professionals at Alliance Insurance Services. Jeremy McCallum and his Alliance Insurance Services team work with a variety of insurance companies competing for your business. Jeremy and the Alliance Insurance Services team helps you find the right insurance at the right price. They know you'll sleep better at night knowing Alliance Insurance Services is handling all of your insurance needs. Give them a call today at 303-431-9351. That's 303-431-9351. And be sure to tell them the AmeriChicks sent you.
Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim on Friday. It is World War II Day, and we have on the phone with us Professor Victor Davis Hansen, and we're going to get back to him to finish up this last segment. We love talking about the Second World War and all of our heroes. And you know, just as important as it was then to make sure that we had the weaponry and the technology that we needed to protect ourselves, we also need to make sure that we can protect our technologies today. So I wanted to share just real quick with you guys, one of our sponsors, EvanYourITGuy.com, amazing, amazing group. They're IT professionals. They provide on-demand help with your computer needs. Give them a call 24/7, no matter what the problem is, hardware, software, external drives, memory, whatever it is, call them and they'll help you. And the great thing about this is, Kim, you know, rather than having to take your computer down to a shop, leave it with somebody, give them your password, you give them access to everything you have and you go for hours without your computer. With EvanYourITGuy.com, you can call somebody on the phone and right away, immediately, they talk to you, they can log onto your computer, you can watch exactly what they're doing from the comfort of your own home, and it's all recorded. So it's you're protected. And this is that's a big thing to have this day. So check out EvanYourITGuy.com. They're one of AmeriChick's favorites. And if you mention the AmeriChicks, you get your first 30 minutes of help for free.
Love it.
So we love it.
Yep. Let's get back to Professor Victor Davis Hansen. Professor Hansen, Molly and I do this show because we think the engaging in the battle of ideas in America today is so important. And what would you say that we could learn from the eradication of Nazism and fascism after the Second World Wars?
Well, I think things can change very quickly, and we can't get pessimistic when things look dark. I don't think the world had ever been in worse shape than 1941. And we mentioned how much of the world was under control of Germany and Italy and Japan. And we had an army that was 17th in the world behind Portugal when the war broke out. And yet in just 2 years, the United States had a larger gross domestic product than the Soviet Union, Britain, Germany, Italy, and Japan put together. And so you can do amazing things in a democracy in a country like the United States. And I think the lesson is that it's mostly up here in our brains and our willpower, our spirit. And what, so when we say we, you know, we can't build a wall, or we can't deter North Korea, or we can't pay down the debt, or we can't do this and we can't do that, those are mental impediments. They're not, there's no reason why we can't. It's just they're self-inflicted or self-imposed barricades. And I think in World War II, that generation said, we have no choice. We're going to try anything. And they said, you can't get a B-29 four-engine bomber that will fly round trip 3,000 miles. It's never been done. And they said, not only will we do it, we'll get it designed, tested, and in the air in a year. And they did. And it won the war. So that generation had no self-limitations, I guess was what I'm saying. And I think in our problem in our society is we say, you can't do that. You need environmental this, or there's some kind of restriction or government or deep state or administrative statute. And the result of it insidiously is that we just become paralyzed and we're afraid to say anything blunt. So Trump comes along and here he says anything he wants. Sometimes the first thing that comes in his head, but nonetheless, people saw that as liberating. And then when he says, I can build a wall or I can get 3%, he said he was going to get 3% growth. And people said, you don't understand. The economy's changing. The population is aging. We have entitlements. We're not productive anymore. It's impossible. We haven't had it for 10 years. Well, for the last two quarters, he's had 3% GDP. So I think that's the message of World War II that we've got to recapture, that we can do almost anything we want.
Yeah.
If we want to go back to the moon, we can. If we want to tell North Korea, you're not going to send a missile toward Portland. Just want to let you know that whatever it takes, that's going to be synonymous with your destruction. We can do that. I mean, there's risk, there's dangers. I know that there's sacrifices, but that generation faced a lot greater danger than we are.
Sure. You know, I love what you're saying, Professor Victor Davis Hanson. You know, the greatest generation had no limitations. They were told they couldn't. They had weaponry they didn't know how to use. So many of our guys said that they were on airplanes that had never been flown before. They had no idea. They were learning because the person in front of them crashed, and they just did it. They just stepped up and did it. And you know, and today, you know, people have been told they can't build that. But you know, we didn't get into the war until Pearl Harbor was bombed, and then somehow after the end of World War II, the United States emerged as a dominant world power. Why do you think that the U.S. inherited the responsibility of protecting other nations against radical ideology and communism and all the different things we are so active around the world protecting others today? How do you think that happened?
Well, what happened is that our partner, the Soviet Union, as soon as the war, or even before the war was over, decided that it had 500 divisions. It had been supplied. 20% of its supplies came from us. It was going to continue a revolution and overthrow the former British colonial world and oppose the United States, have a coup or revolution in China. And the United States looked around and they said, my gosh, France was occupied. It's destitute. And Western Europe is starving and the British Empire is broke and they've nationalized all their industry. And Germany's flat and Japan's in ruins. And who's going to stop this? We don't really want to do it, but I guess we're going to have to do it. And it's even worse than that. They have a great propaganda that they're still liberating people from fascism, colonialism, imperialism. We're stuck with this. Wow, we have to work with the old fascists that we hated, Germany, Italy, and Japan. And we got to change their governments and we got to rehabilitate them. And then we got to tell the world that's magnanimous of why the Soviet Union saying, no, they've joined the enemy. It was a really terrible thing, that predicament that we were put into. And then we succeeded. And I think now the countries that we built up, Japan and South Korea, and Taiwan, and Australia and Western Europe and Britain, they got complacent that we would always do that. And because we're a magnanimous country, we sort of shared our wealth. We had foreign aid. We have trade deals. We started globalization. And now I think it's time to say, you know what? We saved the world for 70 years, and I think you guys in NATO, you guys in the EU, Japan, South Korea, you're going to have to start stepping up and partnering with us. And I think that message, it's not an isolationist message. It's just saying, given the way the world was 70 years, and given what we did to save it, 330 million people in the United States cannot save 6 billion people. You've got to partner with us against ISIS or Iran or North Korea, and you have very sophisticated economies that copied our own, and we were very generous in foreign aid and technology transfers, and we had an open trade system, and we have globalization that we protect, and our Navy keeps the sea lanes, but you're going to have to step up now, and we'll see. I think that's the message that we're hearing from the Trump administration.
Right. Sounds like his NATO speech.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It sounds like we've been taken advantage of for way too long. Our secrets have been hacked, speaking of, you know, getting into our systems. And like you said, we've given so much foreign aid. It's like people have been taking and taking and taking from us. And I agree. It's time for some people to step up.
And I think they will, because they're, for all their criticism of the United States, they understand that all the great universities are here in the United States, all the great medical centers. We're the world's largest producer of natural gas, now oil even, and coal. Our industries are starting to be reborn. We have the cheapest energy costs now in the world. So we're in the middle, I think, of a renaissance. And I think the world is impressed by what we say, and we have influence and clout, contrary to what people say on the left. So I'm confident that we can square, you know, thread that needle by not becoming isolationist, but telling the world, you better start appreciating what you took for granted. And we're not trying to rub it in or anything, but if we want to deal with Iran or North Korea or ISIS, you're really going to have to help us. And I think that message will work. I know it's working with Japan already, and to a lesser extent with South Korea.
So, well, Professor Victor Davis Hanson, we are just about out of time. Your new book, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won, is a fascinating read. As Molly mentioned, it is just zooming to the top of the charts, and really excited about this book. How long did it take you to write this?
Well, you know, it took me a little, about 3.5 years. I have 3 columns a week, and I work at the Hoover Institution. I have a lot of responsibilities, but about 3.5 years, and I'm trying to take a break now because it's the first. After it's really the first time I haven't been working on it in the evening in 3.5 years. So, but it was a long, it took a long, longer than I thought it would. 7,000 books come out every year in World War II. So you can imagine just trying to keep up with the reading was hopeless.
Definitely. When Molly and I went to Normandy, I took a book on Churchill, and she's like, could you have brought a book that might have been a little skinnier than that one? But it was fascinating.
Have you heard of the Kindle? No, she brought the hardback.
I like hardback books, Professor Hanson, so very excited about this. Now, also, what is your website? Because there's a lot of great columns, a lot of great commentary there.
Yeah. I try to put everything there that I write. It's Victor Hanson. That's an HANSON.com, all one word, small letters, VictorHanson.com. And it's got something new there every day.
Well, I do a little writing myself, and I know that it takes a lot of mental energy to just do some short columns. So this book, 3.5 years, that is really something. So we would highly recommend it. That's Professor Victor Davis Hanson, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won.
Thank you so much for all that you do, Victor Hanson. We sure appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Bye.
God bless. I think everybody needs to get out there and get the book. You know, obviously on World War II Day and Marichicks, usually we have a World War II veteran on, but Victor Davis Hanson had so many family members that served in so many different of the conflicts during the war that he makes such a great case in talking about, you know, all the different ways and the different scenarios and the different weapons and the different, you know, I mean, you know, you're going through a jungle at one point, the rest, you're going across the ocean, you're in the sky, you're land, air, sea, there's just so much going on. It's a great book. So definitely check out Victor Davis Hanson's book, The Second World Wars.
Yeah, and you know, that is one of the things that I learned, Molly, as we've gotten to know all these vets from going to Normandy, is there were the guys in the sky, but there were the guys in North Africa, over in the Philippines, the Aleutian Islands, China. It has really kind of crystallized to me the understanding of just how far-reaching this was. So it's a great honor to bring the World War II project Ford every Friday.
Mm-hmm. And just one thing that Victor Davis Hanson said, I wanted to remind everybody, wars aren't started by accident. There are so many people that are worried, saying, oh, just a little thing, a little mistweet or this or that here or there, we're going to start a war. Wars aren't started by accident. They are intentional. So let's make sure that we're leading from the front.
Mm-hmm. And George Patton, quote today, prepare for the unknown by studying how others in the past have coped with the unforeseeable and unpredictable in the past.